Ready? Okay, ready? Welcome to the second day afternoon session of the public meeting of the Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee. Today is June 5th. It's 1 in the afternoon, and we're resuming this public meeting. This morning, our agenda was to take a plant tour. It was very successful. Members of the public were there, and lots of questions and a good tour, which I want to mention here because any of you that are watching, if you watch for our next tour, we'd welcome your participation on the next public tour. We try to do these not every public meeting, but periodically. In fact, the next public meeting, we can't do it because the plant's in an outage. In any event, that having been said, the first item on the agenda is to ask whether any committee members or consultants here at the table have any comments. Anything to add? Hearing none, the next item is public comments and communications. Anybody wishing to address the committee on items not on the agenda, now's your chance. Anything? Thank you. Hearing none on that also, the next item on the agenda that's printed was to review the minutes of the last public meeting in February, but we did that yesterday. And so that one's done, and we're going to go on to the next item on the agenda, which is consultant reports. These are two, in succession, two fact-finding reports that report on visits that our Diablo Canyon Independent Safety Committee made to the plant, one in April and one in May. So the first one will be the April 16-17 fact-finding meeting. I'll introduce our consultant, Rick McBorder, for that one, and the slides for this are in the handout book. Go ahead, Rick.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. All right. As you mentioned, this is a report on the fact-finding trip of April 16th and 17th by Dr. Lamb and myself. The topics are, as you see on the first slide. Our first item on the agenda was meeting with the resident inspector. In this case, it was the resident inspector as the senior was away on a objectivity trip to another station. Met with John Reynosa, talked about several topics. A couple of items of interest is there is an NRC initiative to do a round of public meetings near sites that have decommissioning activities going on. And I believe there has been an ask of the NRC to have one in this area. That's still a developing initiative on the part of the NRC. So we'll need to, hopefully it might be an opportunity for us to participate or at least listen in if it overlaps some of our future meetings. The resident inspector also talked about the first quarter inspection results, which at that time were draft, but we since received a report and some of those items have been talked in the previous presentations. And he also mentioned the results of the Unit 1 R21 outage, and the resident inspections results were generally positive for that outage. The next item we talked about on the agenda was one that I'll spend a little bit of time on, and it was about the future movement of spent fuel, I'll call that, but it was really two specific items we tried to target that are, I think, timely, and we've talked about off and on for several months as well as yesterday. Particularly in line with the Holtec presentation last evening. The first was Dr. Lamb and I had a couple of conversations a few months back about what exactly is the tech spec limit for the minimum amount of time fuel has to remain in the pool after you offload it. We had differing opinions on what that was, our memories. And so our specific question to PG&E was, what defines the actual time as minimum amount of time an offloaded spent fuel semi has to spend in the pool before it can be moved into a cask? And the short answer is 5 years. The long answer is the 5 years comes about because of this table only goes to 5 years. But there's more to it. As you can see, it's a fairly complicated table. The table originates from the spent fuel storage installation updated safety analysis report, the UFSAR. In the back, there is a section 10 that has all the technical limits for storage of fuel at the spent fuel facility. That has tables that define what is the maximum heat load that can be put into a cask for the fuel and what is the maximum burn up for the different assemblies in the different regions. This is one of several tables. This is a table that shows by burn up in megawatt days per million tons uranium. So it says, basically looking at the right hand two columns that would apply to Diablo Canyon, this is for high burn up fuel region one and region two. There's two regions that are loaded into the cask that are defined, and there are different limits for each. But basically, if you've got an assembly that's got 34,000 burn up measured at 34,000, then that has to have more than 10 years of time in the fuel pool before it can be loaded into region two of a cask. So that's kind of how you read the table, and that's why the answer is somewhat nebulous, because you have to analyze these limits for each assembly that goes into each region of the canister. Additionally, there's also a similar table that has actual heat load. It's arranged the same, but the units are thermal units of heat that I can't remember right off the top of my head. But you have to meet the requirements for both tables. And this is part of the Part 72 license.
It's BTUs per something or other.
Right, that it is.
Per
mass of some kind. Per gram or per pound, or I can remember.
Right. Now, only for MPC-32, that is this facility, right? 32 assemblies in the cask.
Yes, that's correct. That's one reason I said the right-hand tables. And this is also, there's also tables for high burn-up fuel and low burn-up fuel.
Right.
I thought I pulled the high burn-up table out, but it doesn't say that at the top. If it's not the high burn-up table, it looks exactly the same. The numbers are just different. There's about 10 of these, and I say this as an example of how the limits are arranged and how you use them. Not that this is a specific, I'm not the expert to tell you this is the exact table that's used for every situation at Diablo Canyon.
Right. I don't even recall what's the definition of region one and region two within the canister.
I don't have that figure, but if you imagine the cross section of the canister where you have the 32 assemblies, there's a square that marks region one and the rest is region two.
The square is in the middle.
Sure, it's kind of an annular space. Right. So,
are these tables in the fact finding report?
Just this example. There is a reference to the UFSAR in the chapter location. These tables are found in section 10.2 of the ISFSA USFAR, which is a public document.
Right. I think that would be good, but it'd be good to check if it's the high burn up table and sure. Have that be the one that's used in the fact finding report, since that will. That's clearly the one that is of the greatest interest.
Rick, there's a little more to it, which I know you know. That is, these tables are to be used as the default because they're in the FSAR. If Diablo were to use these tables, they don't have any question that they would comply with this part of the specification. But as I remember it, for any given IFC canister, they can do a separate analysis and appeal for an exemption or a change in this configuration if there's some demonstration that some other configuration still works for the overall calculation that's the basis for this.
That makes sense to me. We did not discuss that specific approach in the fact-finding.
Yeah, but that, in other words, that, like anything else, you can always ask for an exemption on a defined basis, and the basis that they would allow would be if the overall performance still meets their higher-level criterion, even though the detailed configuration might be slightly different.
Right.
The only rationale for them to do that would be if they were really stuck with a certain loading in the pools that they wanted to rearrange or do something with.
Okay. There's also an element to this. When you go to use the heat table, there's actually a formula in this section of the UFSAR of how you calculate the heat that's coming from each assembly.
Yes.
So you have to use the method defined in the UFSAR to Correct. Calculate the heat coming off the assembly.
Correct. And that method is embedded in an industry standard that the NRC has endorsed that everybody uses. There's a particular, you have to do it, you have to do the analysis this way. There's, right, yeah.
All right. All right, so that was basically the answer to our first line of inquiry, which is what is the actual limits, where do they come from? And the answer is the tables in the UFSAR, which even if you met all the other criteria, don't go below 5 years. And that's typically where the 5-year number comes from, is tossed about.
Well, just looking at the table, it will be a lot longer than 5 years, right? Just looking at the table here, you know, because this facility uses high burn up fuels. So, right. You know, the 7 or 9 years number quoted in the in their submittal in front of the PUC, it's a good number. 5 years, I don't think they can do 5 years.
I don't think so either. And that statement actually, I think, was made in our fact finding meeting, that using high burn up fuel, you can't get as low as 5 years.
Right.
Using the current tables and approved methodology.
Right.
The second point of our meeting, we wanted to inquire about some of the specifics of the RFP. You know, what are the goals? What is hoped to be obtained by the RFP process that PG&E is going through? Basically, what is explained to us, and I think makes sense, is PG&E, by the RFP process, is hoping to take advantage of some of the advances in knowledge and technology that have occurred since original licensing. And by technology, what we mean are primarily the use of advanced materials inside a cask. Holtec mentioned last night the material called metanium, which is aluminum alloy. That is one technical technology advantage that exists today that did not in the previous licensing. With the cast, the key thing to accomplish is to be able to conduct heat from the assemblies to the outer shell. And that keeps the temperature of the fuel down because you can duct it out and it can get to the air. By using alloys that have a higher heat transfer coefficient, I think it's higher, or is it lower?
Higher thermal conductivity.
Higher thermal conductivity, yeah. Thank you. It's been a while since I've been in the classroom.
Which comes down to the heat transfer.
Yeah, thank you for correcting me. As soon as I said that, looking at two PhDs in the audience, three, I knew that I was going to be called out on that one. But currently, the caster design for fuel assemblies, or limits each fuel assembly to about 28 kilowatts of heat for a fuel assembly. There is opinion that using some of the advanced technologies, it could get as high as 50 kilowatts for a fuel assembly. So that allows you to load an assembly earlier into the cask while it's hotter by using these advanced materials, while still keep the temperature of the fuel down below the point where you might get any zirconium hydriding of the cladding. You're not worried about melting the fuel. You're worried about heating the cladding to the point where you could get zirconium hydriding. The other area that could be gauged is the advancement of knowledge in the last since the license was issued. And what we're talking about there is primarily thermal analysis, modeling, and understanding of the thermal properties of a cask and what happens inside the cask. Two basic areas. The modeling analysis has been improved. A lot of efforts through EPRI in the industry, and we were provided some documents that talked about that. The other is there's actually been a study that's sponsored by Department of Energy that's taken place at the North Anna spent fuel installation where they put instrumentation inside of a spent fuel cask that has high burn-up fuel, and they're studying the actual heat transfer inside the cask using the temperature measurements coming out of that cask. Both the advances in modeling and the initial results of that study show that there's perhaps a lot of margin in the analysis and the previous analysis that could be recouped as a part of this effort to allow hotter assemblies to be loaded into a cask. The main goals of the RFP are to, and again, Holtec mentioned this, is to ask for options. What are options that could be provided by companies to do two things? One, to reduce the time spent fuels needed to be in the pool, which is what I've talked about here. But the other is to minimize the overall inventory in the pool. We know that's a concern. many with the new plan that's proposed for 7 years, because that does result in a very high inventory in the pool. And that's one of the objectives of the RFP, is to see if that inventory max in number of that overall inventory can be reduced. Just a couple of other items of note. There are no current CAS contracts in place that would have to be unwound. Those contracts were options at time, but those options were never executed. So there currently are no CAS on order for the facility, waiting the outcome of this RFP process. The goal is to complete the process and be in a position to apply for an amendment by 2021, 2 years out, and to complete the both the licensing approval and the manufacture of the cask in time to support use of the new cask by, or new technology by 2025. It's a very challenging schedule, but that's the purpose and the goal in the RFP. Any questions or discussion on this topic? All right, moving on, another item that I'll probably spend a little bit of time on here is an item that we put on the agenda because of conversations that have been had in the public meeting here that we wanted to follow up on, some concerns that were expressed, and we did not have all the answers. The first item was a concern about a recent relief request that was submitted by PG&E to the NRC code, ASME Section 11 code relief request. Was submitted in late 2018. A conference call had been held in February 2019, right around the time, just before our public meeting. And there was much discussion about that was asking for relief of reactor vessel weld inspections. We discovered that's not the topic of that relief request. I'm going to talk about vessel weld inspections in a moment. But the relief request that was most recently submitted concerned hot leg nozzle visual examinations. So this is for the four hot leg nozzles on each unit to reduce the requirements for the visual examination of those nozzles, not to reduce the actual inspection, but to reduce the resolution and the technical requirements for the camera that's used in the inspections. Currently, the inspection technique is required to meet criteria VT3 of the code inspection code. Is used for visual examination of welds. The inconsistency here is the hot leg nozzle visual exams are not actually weld exams. They're examinations to ensure there's no foreign material on the nozzles that are completed, and they are code required, but they're not weld inspections. And so there's an industry effort. EPRI has been coordinating this. Diablo Canyon is one of the first to reduce the requirement from an actual VT3 weld inspection to just the use of a high-resolution camera, basically to do the same inspection with a less rigorous piece of equipment, for lack of a better word, one that's potentially lower resolution and doesn't have the same calibration and verification requirements. So that relief request is about hot leg nozzles. We got that cleared up. At the same time, we did ask what the weld inspection status was for both units to make sure that was well understood. And there is some complexity to the Unit 1 situation. Unit 1 had its last full reactor vessel weld inspection in 2005. It was undergoing a 10-year inspection in 2013 when there were problems with the robot. And this is a picture of the 15 inspections. I think I said 13. Actually, the welds were inspected in 15 or 13. They were due in 15, so my slide's incorrect there. So in the 13 inspections, they had problems with the robot doing the inspections, and they were only able to accomplish 84% of the welds, inspecting 84% of the welds. So 100% were inspected in 05, 84% were inspected in 13. The follow-up action after they could not complete 100%, at that time, the NRC was approving exemptions to extend the 10-year interval to 20. So PG&E submitted to the NRC an exemption request for approval to extend Unit 1's vessel weld inspections to a 20-year period and make them due next in 2025. And that was approved by the NRC. Had it not been approved, they would have completed the weld inspections at the next outage in 2015, which would have been on schedule. Because the exemption request came in, they left the situation as is, 84% completed for the 2013 inspections, and the next full inspection would have been scheduled for 2025. Since that is now after the cessation of operations date, there are no plans to do further inspections on the Unit 1 welds. So, in summary, the situation on Unit 1 is 100% were inspected in 2005, 84% in 2013, no plans for future inspections. The relief request has been already approved.
So I'm not going to argue with the statement that as it sits, they can say with it correctly that they meet the code.
Right, because they had an approved exemption.
The code allows exemptions. And
right. That's yes.
Right. They meet the code as it is under that exemption provision. But with a straight face, if I was a member of the public, I'd be concerned about some wells that had never been inspected for 20 years. 20 years sounds like a long time. On the other hand, I went and asked questions about this of an expert or two because I'm not a metallurgist. And the basis for this is actually soundly based on specific evidence that this will be okay. That is, it's not just a random, it's okay. It's based on some very detailed analysis of those specific welds and the fluids that they're exposed to and the conditions they're in. So I was satisfied with that, even though it looks on its face to be a troubling. What do you mean? You're going to wait 20 years?
Right.
It's just a fair concern that that people that haven't gone into the details would have, and I think it's hard to explain.
Well, you know, I second that sentiment, Dr. Barnes.
It's hard to explain.
Right. Not only that, you know, since the exemption was granted, and the next inspection will be after the plant shut down. You know, but members of the public could very well indeed raise that concern because this is one of the most critical items on the vessel.
Right. Which
if you remember, I'm sure you were.
Yeah, of course,
event
I understand.
V, you know, from Wash 1400. These relate to the accident sequence.
Oh,
event V.
I'm in completely, completely. I agree. On the other hand, in order for this to make sense, you want to be sure that it isn't just one person's opinion, but that there's a broad community of experts whose understanding weighs in on this and there aren't important objections to it. And if that's the case, then I'm comforted because the reason this came about was some experts wrote that code. And if those that wrote the code and maintain the code and who maintain that expertise are satisfied, then I'm satisfied.
You mean they allow explicitly an exemption request?
But on a defined basis.
On a what?
On a defined basis.
I see.
It's not just I have to use those words again. On a defined basis.
So this is not a blanket allowance.
No, it's not only not blanket, but the defined basis is spelled out in the code, and they have to meet all the definitions in that defined basis. Mm-hmm. And they did.
We also inquired about the typical results of the inspections, and typically there are no indications that exceed thresholds, and there are no indications that are noted to be growing. That's what they've seen in the past.
Yeah, a way of saying that backwards would be, if when they did the 84% inspection way back then, there were a whole lot of suspicious things they saw, you'd wonder, but there weren't any. In fact, as I understand, there weren't any. Is that correct? That's a piece of the argument.
Right. On the first 100% inspection, there were not any suspicious discovery, and on the 83%, there weren't any. Right.
Now, that's my understanding. Do I have that right? That's what I think.
That's what we were informed.
Well, what I wrote down in my notes is no indications exceeding the threshold, and most of them were original construction indications that have been there the whole time.
Yeah, the way of saying it is there are no indications that there has been any change since original construction.
Right, or any indications that are large enough to require action, further action by the code.
Whatever their threshold was.
Right. The code has thresholds above which you have to do additional inspections.
Exactly.
There's not automatically you go to fix something. There's additional requirements if you find anything above the minimum threshold. They have no indications above that minimum threshold requiring further action.
Yeah, and so on that basis, I'm personally willing to accept that everything was done according to Hoyle. In other words, that they met the code with margin, because those codes have a lot of margin in them to begin with, which you want, which you need.
But it's not doesn't look the best optically to extend the inspection rather than to do it. I agree. Just another point, is this reminds us that to do the inspection, you do have to remove the lower internals of the reactor. That is not normally done during a refueling outage. So, to say while you're in the outage, you got it open, can you go look? Well, yes, you have the head off, but you don't typically remove the lower internals to the point where you can access all these welds in this situation. That's an additional step than what's normally done during an outage. The other point would be on Unit 2. Unit 2 had 100% weld inspection in 2016, no exemption request. It would next be due in 26, which again is after the cessation of operations. So the exemption situation only applies to Unit 1.
So are you saying by the time Unit 2 need that inspection, it would have shut down already?
That's correct. 2026 would be the next due date.
Sounds good.
Okay. Unless there's further discussion on that topic, I'll move on. We next talked about the Performance Improvement Program. This was both a routine general review of the Performance Improvement Program, which we saw a presentation on yesterday, and also a follow-up item on one specific item that came out of a previous fact-finding meeting in November. I don't have the date. Previous fact-finding meeting where the fact-finding team was sitting in on a corrective action review board meeting. The corrective action review board was discussing the reduction in the number of notifications that had been seen over the last few years. That, again, was talked about a little bit yesterday. And this graph was a part of that corrective action review board meeting, and you can see the tailing off in the trend in the number of notifications over the years. And yesterday we were showing them a more detailed version of this. Performance Improvement Department did do an assessment of this issue at the request of the Corrective Action Review Board, concluded there was no single cause for this, and in particular there was no reluctance on the part of employees to submit corrective action notifications. And that's a key term. You look at this graph and you think, down is good. The fewer notifications means things are better, unless it means employees are more reluctant to submit. That's the other possible solution, and that was the main purpose of the assessment, was to eliminate that possibility. And that was their conclusion, that there was not a situation where people were becoming more reluctant to submit notifications of problems in the plant. Instead, they felt there was multiple reasons this was going down: better human performance, better equipment reliability, reduced number of capital projects, and preventive maintenance activities as the plant approaches cessation of operations. And such, if you have a 10-year PM, it's no longer required to be done because you're not going to exceed the 10-year interval, so numbers are just naturally tracking down in the number of activities. That was the result of that assessment. Elsewhere in the department, just a couple of items of note. There has been some movement of personnel. Department manager, Mr. Fronheim, had been moved to the part of the fire recovery effort, and Mrs. Shatara had temporarily taken his position. We've seen that in several parts of the station where people are being moved around temporarily. And they also had been looking closely at the effect of bankruptcy on performance at the station. We asked this of the Performance Improvement Group as well as several others if they'd seen any effects. And they immediately said, no, we have been looking at that both formally and informally. And they gave their basis as several points. First is direct interviews and people in the field. They felt like they had a lot of conversations with people in the field. And they found people that felt like it affected their day-to-day work, bankruptcy. In general, people working in the field at Diablo Canyon feel pretty insulated from the immediate effects of the bankruptcy. They also reviewed anonymous notifications and did not see any changes in that. In other words, people weren't, because they're reluctant to submit notifications, you would expect if they're reluctant to submit them formally, they might start increasing the number of anonymous notifications, and they had not seen that. They also did a self-assessment in the refueling outage about human error event rates, and there was no change there, and there were no department-level event during the recent outage. So just general, their conclusion is, as of this time, no effect of bankruptcy on performance at the station. They, as well as everybody else, continues to be concerned, you know, looking ahead 1 to 3 years out, what will be the effect not only of the bankruptcy, but as the shutdown approaches and turnover of personnel may start to increase. The last thing on that point is they just to make, they feel like probably the first area that they're watching most closely, the first area that problems would be revealed is most likely to be the maintenance department, which makes sense. It's a department that generally has the highest turnover, the highest number of temporary workers, and does the most number of activities that can have errors or higher number outside of operations. So they were watching maintenance in particular. So that was performance improvement program. Next item on our agenda was foreign material exclusion program. We typically review this after every outage. The program is generally healthy. There was a bit of a negative trend identified during the most recent outage, 1R21. Specifically, there were three threats that occurred during the outage. And a threat is where an event occurs where foreign material is discovered. And if they had not discovered it and removed it, they could have had an injury or a system failure. There could have been further damage to the plant. Those are the threat categories. The items that happened, just to give you a flavor, there was what they call a D-ring found in the reactor cavity after the cavity had been declared an FME zone. They felt like that ring was probably in there on the initial inspection and just missed. They never identified where it came from. Workers on the reactor head had a tool come loose from its lanyard and dropped down into the mechanisms, and they went to retrieve it with a magnet. The magnet broke apart and spread parts around the head that they had to go retrieve.
Mess.
And then they had a contractor in the water box for the condenser who dropped a piece of inspection equipment down into the water box inlet, and which was underwater at the time in the water, and they had to send divers down to retrieve that item.
Divers.
Sorry?
Divers.
Divers, yes.
Divers.
Scuba
divers. Underwater scuba divers down into the water that was present in the Cirque Water Tunnel to retrieve that item. So that's three threats versus one for the previous outage, 2R20. There was the conclusion of what was going on is that the station needed improved awareness of the requirements of the FME program.
Going back to those FME events, each of them got reported and fixed, right? Because the thing you also worry about is that somebody drops something and then doesn't want to get embarrassed. And
yes, that's correct. They were all tracked and resolved, but the items were removed. So there were several awareness bulletins on this topic issued during the outage. It was also believed that some of the changes to temporary worker training may be playing a factor. That was mentioned in our previous review just after the Unit 2 outage. And it's my recommendation that we follow up on temporary worker training, and Dr. Peterson and myself have that on our preliminary agenda for the next visit to look at. We have on our open items list, it's time to look at non-licensed operator training, so we're going to pick that area and go take a look at what changes have been made to the temporary worker training program over the last few years. So overall, it's a good story. The FME program has been effective, but there have been some threats and some concerns in the area, and we should continue to follow up on this after every outage. We did also ask about the upcoming outage in the main generator. That's a very big project. We asked how FME is going to be managed during that. I think you all, if you've ever been by a turbine or a generator when it's open during outage, you know there's a very large FME area, barricades and everything established. We asked how that was going to be managed, and the answer is the contractor performing the work on the generator has as part of their scope of supply to provide the FME procedures, controls, personnel, equipment, basically to manage the FME program for the generator rewind project. And that contractor has done similar work, including the FME scope here at the station when doing turbine work and other activities in the station. So they felt like it was a contractor who had proven the ability to do this in the past would be asked to do it again in this portion of the project. All right, the rest of the items move through fairly quickly. We went to attended a Plant Health Committee meeting. One thing we learned at the Plant Health Committee meeting was that the format of these meetings have changed slightly. They're classifying the meetings as strategic or tactical. In this case, this was a tactical meeting, and the specific tactical focus was on operations. So the meeting focused on going through several lists that are maintained of operator issues. These included operator workarounds, operator priority equipment that they believe need to be repaired. Basically, they keep a separate list of equipment needing to be repaired that, and say these are the ones we think need to be worked first. That's a control by procedure called B38 repairs. List of main enunciators, list that are defeated, list of operator burdens, and list of resolution of adverse condition monitoring plans. All those things are tracked on list as adding burdens to the operators, and the Plant Health Committee went through those lists and made sure they were satisfied with the plans to resolve those items on each of those lists. And that discussion was detailed, focused on operational safety, and initiated more follow-up where it was required. We looked at the management observation programs, the routine discussion of what is the program now for requiring managers to get out in the field with their employees. We did find there's been a change in this program. It used to be previously that supervisors, managers, and directors all had a certain number of observations they needed to do out in the field. And those observations, their completion would be tracked by an app on cell phones. The focus has changed. The focus now is currently on getting first-line supervisors out in the field with their workers. And they document what they observe with their workers in the field, and they are rolled up into quarterly operations review meetings, ORMs. The PICOs, Plant Performance Improvement Coordinators, for each department assist in those meetings. They review all the observations of first-line supervisors and come up with corrective actions if they're needed. We provided a list of the operations review meeting results for the maintenance department, maintenance support department, and saw that there are items like safety concerns, human performance concern, technical questions, communications issues, and it seemed like a good process. We did also ask what happens to managers and directors now. What are they required to do? And the answer is managers are the ones that define what the supervisors have to do, how often they get out in the field, and they also participate in the ORMs. And then the directors are responsible to review the results of the ORMs and decide if there's a focus area that's needed across their departments. We also looked at the flow accelerator corrosion program. Flow accelerator corrosion is where a high temperature mixed fluid, a fluid with most steam and water in a mixed form, is in carbon steel piping, can cause corrosion. It's probably more in an erosion type situation, but it basically accelerates the corrosion. And so the industry has known about this issue for quite a while, and there's monitoring in place where inspections are done on a regular basis of piping that is susceptible to this phenomena. The status of the program at Diablo Canyon is in good shape. Over the years, Diablo Canyon has replaced a lot of the carbon steel piping susceptible to FAC flow accelerator corrosion with alloy piping, so it's no longer susceptible to that. They're currently replacing the polisher piping as part of that effort. And in general, because of those piping replacements and the upcoming shutdown, the number of inspections is starting to go down. Unit 1 R20 was 47 inspections, and Unit 1 R21 was 27 inspections. In all those inspections in 1 R21, there were no emergent replacements. In other words, there were no inspections that had unsatisfactory results that required replacement of the piping. So they continue to be able to just monitor the situation through inspections, the appropriate sections. Direct current power systems was a system that we looked at. It's battery chargers and inverters. They're all in good shape. A few minor issues present on some non-vital batteries. They are having some cracking of the lids. And on a vital battery, one cell has low voltage on unit 2 and may require replacement soon. In general, the batteries are in good shape, having been replaced in the last 8 years for the vital batteries and over the period of 4 to 11 years for non-vital batteries. The inverters were replaced in 1994, good for 40 years. Chargers in 2004, good for 40 years. So we asked the question, will you need to do any more replacements before shutdown? And it's an interesting answer. The answer is, it's unclear how long the DC power system will be needed after shutdown. And if you think about it, this is a system that may be required for a while, particularly to support spent fuel pool operations or other things around the station until the regulatory requirements are relaxed, because it is your source of power if off-site power is lost or diesels are lost in combination. No,
but it isn't just just that. It's also currently DC supports a lot of instrumentation and the like,
right?
And control, and whether that will extend to which systems at that time is, I don't know the answer, but they must know.
They don't know yet. You have to identify what systems are
going
to be required.
There'll
have to be a plan of when systems are going to be start to be no longer required.
They're going through it.
And then reduce the scope of the DC systems. It's just an interesting observation. This is one system that you don't just turn off when the plant shuts down. You have to do a more methodical approach to decide what's needed to remain in service and what's no longer needed, much like a cooling water system, component cooling or something.
Yeah.
All right, last two items in the agenda. Dr. Lamb met with Jim Welch, the Vice President and Chief Nuclear Officer. While he was meeting with Mr. Welch, I went and performed a control room observation. Found the control room was neat and orderly and generally quiet overall, and the communications that were being performed were formal, and in three-way communication was observed. That's the end of the report. We'll take any questions or comments.
Now, if I may add, in my meeting with the chief nuclear officer, two subject matter that's of interest to me and to the committee. One is on decommissioning. I was informed by the chief nuclear officer that now, instead of having a delegated presence on the engagement panel, he now sits on the engagement panel. On the bankruptcy issues, my inquiry has to do with, does the bankruptcy filing itself have any impact on the budget and on morale? And so far, the answer is not on the budget at all, so he still had the same operational budget. Now, in future expenditure, I would believe that may be subject to review by the bankruptcy judge, but that hasn't happened yet because his current budget is not impacted. And on morale, this is a theme that we constantly make inquiry about. You know, how does the bankruptcy impact on plant operation and morale? And so far, the observation is neutral. There is clearly an absence of major adverse impact. But we had to wait and see.
Mm-hmm. So does that complete your report?
It does.
Are there any further questions or observations from the committee or the consultant?
It's on.
I can pull it forward and ask again, but there, hearing none from the
committee and the consultants. Any comments from members of the public? No.
Hi, I'm Sherry Lewis from San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace.
Welcome.
Well, thank you. I found several parts of this alarming. Some of it is because I had a terrible time understanding the table. I didn't know, I finally figured out multi-purpose canister 24 assemblies. What's 24E or EF? What does that mean?
So for Diablo Canyon, they're licensed to use different types of assemblies. What they currently use is the multi-purpose canister 32. So only the two right columns apply at Diablo Canyon currently.
The others apply to other reactors elsewhere.
Okay. Then my question is to, 39,800 is is hot, and 43,000 is hotter.
It's a higher burnup. It's been in the reactor for a longer period of time. That means hotter.
Okay, so when you put an assembly in the reactor, it starts at one thing, and then it gets hotter and hotter. That's right, because you can touch them practically.
Right. So this is burnup. There's a different table. So this is like the number of miles on your car. Your car starts at zero, and this would be like it's got 40,000 miles on the car. And it's 40,000 megawatts have been generated per million tons, but that's just the units. But it's how much fuel that fuel has burned.
Oh, I understand.
So the higher,
right?
The higher the burn up, the longer it has to stay in the pool.
Now these are the ones on the right. You might as well put the graph up, you know, so people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, thank you.
So in region 2, that means it's not heating up as much as this one, region 1.
Correct. So the way you would read it is, if you're putting an assembly in region 2, it has to be colder.
And region 2, is that the inner or the outer?
I can find that out. I don't know off the top of my head.
The inner square, I think it's 9
right.
of them. And then the outer is the rest of, 23 making 32.
Well, right, I understand, but the inner, is that the hotter stuff?
Yes.
Okay, so the inner would be region 1.
I think it might be the other way around, actually, if I may. I think you put the cooler ones, you're allowed to put...
You put the cooler ones in the middle?
Right, because you want... It's harder to get the heat out from the ones in the middle.
I've heard it both ways.
I'd be glad
to do a follow-up on this.
You're probably right.
Well, anyway, the point of all of this...
You're probably right. You want the cold ones in the middle.
Where the balance with shielding, though.
Okay.
I don't know where shielding...
Well, there's reasons for either way. I can understand that. All right, so let me finish. That's it for now. To go on to the weld inspections, which is... I guess... Okay, the weld... There's no picture for that that I'm thinking of. In 2005, the welds... For Unit 1, and we don't worry about Unit 2 at all because that's all been taken care of. In Unit 1, in 2005, all the welds were inspected.
Right.
And you talked about, after that, you talked about approaching threshold or not approaching threshold. In any case, it was below a threshold. So everything seems to be okay. And then in 2013... You couldn't get all of them done for, I forget why, something went wrong.
The robot broke.
The robot broke?
Yes.
You hear that? The robot broke.
We know.
I'm telling everybody else,
yep.
too. So that's 84% of the welds were checked. I wonder, of those 84%, how the welds compared in 2013 compared to 2005. I mean, they probably didn't look identical to 2005.
We asked that question. In general, there was no growth observed by any of the indications. That was the tip.
No growth at all or no growth beyond a threshold?
No growth at all.
Really? Okay, that's good.
Yes.
But you don't know what happened with the other 16%.
Of course, that's the point.
That is the point. So the other 16% has not been examined since 2005. And that is a serious thing. And I now when you, this is dumb, but anyway, we're talking about inside the reactor, right?
Oh, yes.
Inside the reactor. So when you take the fuel out, that means the reactor is empty, kind of. The fuel assemblies are all taken out, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay, this is something I should have learned before, but didn't.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay, so the reactor is empty. So you put a machine down there to, well, I guess it's this machine here in the picture, to inspect all of, to inspect all of the welds.
Correct.
Now, at a later time, you were talking about something dropped in the water.
Oh, that
was that of the reactor?
No, completely different.
Okay, good. That's something else then.
That was a foreign material. Completely different.
Yeah. Okay. How can they get away with not inspecting the 16% since 2005? I mean, is the 16% near the top, or what's the difference between what was inspected and what wasn't in as location? Nobody knows.
Well, no, I don't know the location. I think Dr. Budnitz had a good explanation on why this is permissible. You were talking about the code approval exemption process.
All right, that's what bothered me, too. They meet the code under exemptions based on detailed analysis. I think I was trying to quote you on that.
Yes. Which is in the code.
So you do have to trust that that the exemption was valid.
No, correct. That
I
is,
mean, I have to trust
no,
that
no,
the
but,
exemption
but engineers
was valid.
Engineers who are experts don't rely only on that. Okay.
So, as you said, which I liked, you said you need a broad community of experts that agree, and some experts, you know, for example, wrote the code. So then you were saying on a defined basis. Can you explain to me what you mean by on a defined basis?
Yes, in the code, there is a set of specific criteria which must be present in order that the exemption can be allowed. And that criterion has to do with certain material properties and the location of the items and various things. And they met those conditions. Had they not met it, they wouldn't have met the code. Okay.
So I guess, so what? So I just have to trust that they all did this in the right way.
Well, I mean, frankly, I have to trust it too. I'm not a metallurgist. But
right.
But the way this works is that the code itself requires both a demonstration by the owner and
Pugini.
An independent review by independent experts, so as they're not relying only on the owner's assertion. Okay?
Hmm?
Oh, and then the NRC has to review all that.
Well, personally, I don't entirely trust the NRC, but that's beside the point here. Okay, so my question about approaching a threshold, as you said, it did not even in the 2005 inspection, the 2013 and the 2005, 84% of the 13 were identical.
Yes, there was
identical enough.
That's an important piece of the confidence was that there hadn't been, I mean, or had that been otherwise, there would have been more questions raised than there were.
Okay, and the reason why they didn't want to go into the 16%, I assume, is because it's the lower internals of the reactor, and you have to get down into it. People don't go in, do they? Just machinery.
No. It would be too radioactive.
That's what I thought. To
do that routinely. If it was a real emergency, you might, but you wouldn't.
Yeah, in that case, you'd be willing to
You would wait, or you would wait a year. Or, I mean, there's a whole lot of things that you do if you really.
Now, to be responsive to Ms. Lewis' inquiry, Mr. McCauley, maybe we should put it on our agenda. The next time we are on site, let us pursue an inquiry on one, what does the exemption request look like? Two, and on what basis did the agency approve it?
That's pretty good.
Yeah. We will follow up on that.
I actually did pull the agency's approval. I didn't look at it in detail, but I verified that it was out there in the public domain. So I actually already have that.
Right, but do you have the exception request?
I don't think I do.
Yeah,
it's referenced in there. That's what I was about to say. We can get to it quite easily. It's in the NRC Adams system.
Let us examine these two documents.
But I believe that my statement that an outside peer review is required was also part of that. That's what I remembered.
It should be in the NRC safety evaluation report, if that's the case.
Yeah.
Right. We'll do that.
Okay. Then the last thing, where was it that the D-ring was found in the cavity?
Oh.
Where did that come from? And then tried to get it with a magnet. I'm just repeating for fun. Tried to get it with a magnet, and it broke apart. Divers had to go in?
Before he answers that question, you need to understand that from time to time, some oddball thing like this happens, and no matter how hard they try, they can't track down. They just can't track it down.
No, I understand that.
I mean, it's just one of these oddball things.
Yeah.
The purpose of this program is to make sure the foreign material doesn't float around and get where it doesn't supposed to as the water flows around the system and might jam something out.
Foreign material.
Of course, foreign material is not a good thing in a system of circulating water. So they have a program, and this program worked. That is, it worked. They found it.
But where was all this that divers would go in?
Oh, Rick will
go in
explain.
Where?
All right, those were three separate events. The D-ring was found in the cavity, which was near the reactor area, but it's over to the side. The tool that came loose was up on the head. That's before the reactor is disassembled when they're disconnecting the control rod mechanism.
At the top.
And the piece of equipment that fell down where the divers had to retrieve was in the condenser. That's out in the turbine building. So these are not all in the two of them are in the area of the reactor. None of them are inside the reactor. The third was out in the turbine building.
Well, I'm glad of that. Good. And then
we are too.
And then reduced training may be the cause of some of this. And there were other areas in here, too, that indicated reduced training. And that bothers me, too. You know, are things getting, because you're losing some experts, so you have people that don't know quite as much that are taking over some of these jobs. Are you losing personnel so that you don't have quite enough people, or at least not enough really knowledgeable people? So that's my concern.
You want to answer that, Rick?
Well, I think, and we purpose to follow up specifically on the topic of supplemental outage worker training. We know that's been changed over the few years, at least we've been told that, to see if those changes were appropriate.
Well, but it's fair to say that there are two broad categories of supplemental workers. There are supplemental workers, meaning they're not employed at the plant, they come in for the outage, who are true experts in what they do, and they may spend 3 weeks at Diablo Canyon and then spend 3 weeks at another station in the east, and maybe they'll go to Spain, depending on their specific expertise. And those people don't need much training because they're experts. And then there's a lot in between. There's a whole spectrum. But at the other end are people that don't know anything about anything. They're hired at the labor hall in the local. I mean, they're not dumb. They're just not nuclear people. They're hired in the local labor hall to do various tasks, and none of them can go into the facility without training about the nuclear. You know, there's a bunch of stuff you have to know because it's a reactor. It's not a refinery. It's a reactor. And so they have specialized training tailored to the tasks they are, which are not necessarily high tech, but nevertheless they are what they are. So those two categories are dealt with differently.
And you had one complicating factor due to the bankruptcy. PG&E is obligated to give advance notice before the filing. I think Dr. Butner's remind me, I thought it was 16 days. I think Dr. Butner's remind me maybe 15 days. Nonetheless, they are obligated to give advance notice before they actually file. As soon as that notice was given, it create a problem for the refueling outage contracting landscape. Immediately, the contractor would raise the concern, would they get paid?
Fair enough. You'd ask that question, too.
Right. Yeah. Now, when the bankruptcy was filed, the first order of business by the lawyer is to ensure the payroll integrity is protected. And so they file a motion in front of a bankruptcy judge for approval of certain expenditures, and that cover the refilling outage contracting employee. So that issue went away. But before that actual filing of the bankruptcy case, that uncertainty was there. So I would speculate that had an adverse impact on the training time available.
Oh, I don't remember that, but it could. You might be right. I don't remember it. Go ahead.
Okay, well, so, I was going to change the subject, but go ahead.
Right. So you know, as Dr. Bundes was saying, training of a temporary contracting staff, it's a complicated process, right? You need to give time, and you really don't know who you're going to get. Hopefully, you get the same crew from last time.
Right. I understand what you're saying. About contracts for casks. There are no current contracts now
It's our understanding there are no more besides... That's right.
No, there are none.
That's
so
correct.
So they cannot begin expediting transfer...
There's no more.
Anyway.
That's right. There's no more.
So those of us who want expedited transfer, the problem is there are no casks to transfer into. Is that true?
Today there aren't.
There are not. It takes a couple years to make them.
That's correct.
If you're lucky.
Okay. It takes 2 or 3 years
to make them. No, just to say, if they have an RFP on the street that ends up with...
What's cast, RFP?
A request for proposal, excuse me. A bidding contest. If they put out bids and they choose a cask different than the ones that are now, it'll take longer because they have to get approval. If they choose the exact same one, they've got approval, they just have to make them. So the time it takes for the first casks to come in the door will depend on whether or not in that bidding thing that's in front of us, they make a decision to do this or this. And none of us can know because that's completely unknowable.
Now, do we have on our committee's record the rationale behind the licensees not ordering any new casks?
Yeah.
What was the rationale? Do you remember?
Yes.
They didn't need it because they wanted to
because they knew they would be facing, they got to order enough for the whole rest of the thing, right? The whole.
Right.
And they were mulling over whether they wanted to continue with the ones they had been using right along or not. And so they didn't want to order more of them while they were mulling over that decision. So now
Either that or they wanted to force the issue.
So the effective consequence of not ordering, so there will be a de facto time delay.
Right.
It takes time for the cast to come.
That's correct.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, and it may have been on purpose,
that's
too,
correct.
As far as
that's correct.
I know.
Now, you know, they could have, in December, when they filed that thing, they could have said, we're going back to the old system, and that's what we're going to use until the end. They could have, but they didn't.
Why did they consider not going back to the old system?
Oh, because the new system has certain advantages, which they are still not sure they want to go and use, but which they're exploring still. They explained that in the meeting here, I guess the last or the
Yeah, I
one.
Don't it's always okay. understand stuff.
They explained it before the engagement panel
right.
as well, and we've looked at it.
Did we
The new ones would, if they went with them, have a higher capacity.
And all the casks that are being done now are deal with high burn up fuel.
Yes,
right?
Well, the old ones did too.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
That's right. But the idea that they may change to a different cask design, including perhaps a different vendor, was that they were considering the option of a different cask that had a higher capacity.
That would be like the 37 assemblies.
Well, there are any number of – there are several vendors. And so,
I mean, right now we're doing the 32.
How that comes in, we're going to have to wait and see what comes in. We, and of course PG&E more importantly, got to wait and see what comes in the door and find out whether what comes in the door is in fact offers for cask designs that meet their criteria. They don't know which of the several vendors in the world – by the way, it's worldwide – will offer which designs. They have some specifications, but they have to await – company number 44 may or may not decide to bid at all. So they're going to make that decision only after what comes in the door comes in.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to wait and see, too.
So, Dr. Lamb, you did not realize that they no longer had any casks to use?
No, we've understood
well,
that.
He seems not to know. Right. I do not recall.
Do I have that right?
Did I explicitly ask them the question?
I think they have no more.
You effectively stopped the loading campaign, right? What had happened is, with absent any new cast, there's no loading campaign.
Right, and I want to suggest that it may be purposeful, in order to use the graph that they wanted to use.
Look. I want to be sure that what I said to you is correct. Does everybody else here concur that I don't think they have any more? Is that right, Rick?
That's my understanding.
Yeah, that's my understanding.
I mean, we've talked about that in Mothers for Peace for months.
Of course.
Okay. Well, I suppose as fun as this is, that's all I have for now.
Yeah. By the way, one last thing. Whenever this idea of the new casks and if they choose, unless it's identical, they've got to go through a licensing process of the NRC, and that those of us here, and we said this yesterday, we all believe on our committee that that's not a quick process. Okay. You agree with that, everybody?
Yes, indeed. As a matter of fact, in there. Filing in front of the Public Utility Commission, you know, they make a couple critical assumptions. They assume the licensing process of a new cast can be expeditiously completed within a 2 years time frame, which is exceptionally optimistic.
I mean, it's possible, but it's not a lock.
It's like assuming there will be a repository.
No. Okay, Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power Incorporated. Just a couple of comments in response to Ms. Lewis. The key issue about the weld inspections is it's a robust statistical analysis. In other words, it wasn't just, we'll throw this up against the wall. No, there was a whole bunch of very, very careful analysis, and certain conditions had to be met for that 16% exemption. And I think that really, it was not, again.
That's what I said.
Yeah, that's exactly what Bob said. So I just wanted to restate that. I also wanted to talk a little bit about temporary outage worker training because of my firsthand experience. I was a temporary outage worker hired in a hiring hall. I was hired with a PhD in radiation biophysics as a laborer in 2007. And the important thing about the training was the training took place before there was any possibility of doing work.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
So it is front-end loaded.
Of course, by regulation.
And that really does serve to, in other words, assuming that things are designed properly, you don't get into a situation. I would believe that the issue of the condenser, which, again, is in the secondary loop, it's not where radiation is, it's just simply a tool dropped. Yep, shut up. That it was it did require a diver, but the safety consequence was low, but it was important from the standpoint of FME, which again is drilled into your head when you are training. You take a bunch of steps to avoid, like, inadvertently dropping a tool, but people make mistakes. And again, all it did was they had to take a diver to get the item back out of the condenser. So again, nothing. I would. It's not a worry. Thank you.
Any other comment on the fact-finding report? I'll entertain a motion that we accept the report.
I'll second the motion.
Okay, without dispute, okay, Peter?
No, not at all.
Okay, we've accepted the report, and that means it's now a public document, and will also go into our annual report in due course. The next and last agenda item for this public meeting is a fact-finding report by our consultant, Furman Wardell. This is a fact-finding meeting in May 8th and 9th, just less than a month ago, that he did with Per Peterson, and Furman, the floor is yours. And we're going to end at 3, period. Okay.
Somebody has to get on the plane.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This report is on the May 8 and 9 fact-finding meeting, which Dr. Per Peterson and I attended. My delay in getting up here was, I think there are casts available. I was checking a fact-finding report to see if that were the case, and it didn't get quite far enough. So we looked at these 11 items. I'm not going to go over each one now because I've got a slide for each one, and we'll go with the slides. Our first meeting was with Jim Welch, the site vice president and chief nuclear officer, and we try to meet with Jim or an officer or a director at each fact-finding meeting. We talked about these items. The first two were some improvements in the security. One was the outer vehicle inspection station, where all vehicles go through, including employees, to get into the station. They had eliminated that based on analysis and approval from NRC, and now they count on the inner vehicle inspection station without having both. The second item, Mr. Humshey mentioned yesterday as one of the outstanding licensing items, was the devitalization of the intake area. I'm not going to cover that. He covered that pretty adequately yesterday, I thought. The NRC force on force drill, as Mr. Humshey said yesterday, went very well. There were no violations or findings. Pretty impressive performance. We asked Jim Welch about the bankruptcy and what effect that might be having on the plant, and he indicated that that was done by the station, by the company, mainly to protect from wildfire costs, and that had not affected the cash flow at the plant here. Now, we know the capital projects have been cut back. That's a separate situation, and those have been analyzed quite thoroughly by the station and reviewed by us, and we have no concerns on the capital cutbacks. We concluded, as we always do, that the regular meetings with the officers are quite beneficial for both us and the officer. We then talked with ops about the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations, or INPO, INPO, observation of operations back in March. This was a small INPO team that came in to look at operations in advance of the August 2019 full evaluation, which will take place in a couple months. And they do several of these preliminary observations of maintenance, engineering, in this case, operations. And item 3 shows what they looked at. They went to the control room and out in the field to watch operators. They looked at clearance performance, where operators clear items, take them out of service, deactivate them, so maintenance can work on them. Infrequently performed evolutions, those are procedures that aren't done very often, typically during outages, and this was during an outage. They looked at a containment spray pump event, which we looked at before. And the last two bullets are drain down and mode changes and startup during the latter stages of the outage where the unit was coming back into service. And overall, the observation resulted in quite positive results. There were a few areas for improvement, but they were very minor, and the overall results were quite positive. We look at a program, usually each fact-finding meeting. In this case, we looked at one called the Configuration Management Program, which we've looked at every couple of years. And basically here, the idea is the program manages the configuration of the plant to be sure that what's in the plant matches the as-built drawings, which show what's supposed to be there, and that matches the design requirements. So those three have to match those configurations, and the program assures that they do. Sometimes after an outage, they have a number of projects, modifications to components in the plant where the as-built drawings take a little longer to catch up than, say, during non-operations time. And they were playing catch-up here, trying to get the as-built drawings to match the configuration of equipment in the plant. It's not a big deal. It's just more of an administrative type of thing. Item four, they do have performance indicators like almost every program in the plant does, or 12 of them. Overall, they were green. I think two of them were white, and they were going to catch those were the outage catch-up, basically, drawings. And they had planned to catch those up, I think, by mid-year this year. We found the performance for the program was satisfactory. And we talked about this yesterday a bit, wireless information technology and the power block. The power block is primarily the turbine building and the aux building. And some years ago, Diablo Canyon started to implement a wireless policy to facilitate data collection and communications within the power block. With the joint proposal, they put those on hold. Sometime after that, they did a scoping analysis and found the project was so complex and expensive that they just said, we're not going to do it. We're going to cancel it. It's too bad because it would have had made some improvement in work process, as Pierre will tell you. But they get along without it, and they'll be doing okay. So basically, it was canceled. I think we closed that on our open items list yesterday. System we looked at this time was the high-pressure injection system, also known more primarily as the safety injection system here at Diablo Canyon. We met with the system engineer, went over the system diagram, that's the piping diagram, flow diagram, explained to us its operation. This is an emergency system, part of the emergency core cooling systems, which is comprised of three or four different systems. And basically, this system is used in a loss of coolant accident to make up cooling and cool down the reactor core. So it's a pretty important system. It's got double redundancy. It's got seismically designed. It's got all the bells and whistles that any safety-related system should have. We toured Unit 1, safety injection pumps, the pump rooms with the system engineer. The room was clean and orderly. The pumps were not operating because they're emergency pumps, and there's no emergency at the time. We looked at the system health, and the system health is green for both units 1 and 2, and we found the system to be quite satisfactory in its health. Here, Dr. Peterson and I are inspecting two of the Unit 1 safety injection pumps. And as you can see, the rooms are quite clean. The pumps are nice and shiny, and they look to be in good shape. Now, professional development. With the joint proposal and the early shutdown, I'll call it, employees, we think, could be worried about their jobs ending sooner than they had planned here at Diablo. And that concern, we thought, might be on their minds such that they're not giving full attention to nuclear safety. And we said, well, what about that? And we thought, well, let's see what the station or the company is doing to help these employees once their job ends, to do something. And they developed an employee resource center, which is fairly new, pair within the last year, perhaps. Hector's Garden, yeah, nodding yes. A separate facility in the plant where it's manned by one and possibly two people. And they have employees that are concerned can go in there, and they can look at any of these five paths on the bullets here as far as what they might want to do next if they're going to leave, let's say, in 2025 or shortly thereafter. Certainly, some are going to retire. That's pretty clean cut for them. Yep, I got my bonus money or my tranche, and I'm just going to retire when that happens, and that's fine. Others want to continue with their careers. They're young, or they need to continue. So PG&E has a career development program for them, and it's a quite generous tuition plan and help with career changes or furthering their career somewhere else. That was the one most employees went in looking at. Also, there are avenues to work here in the county. Not necessarily county jobs, but other jobs, maybe government or non-government jobs in the county itself. There's help for that. There's also help on nuclear industry specialized jobs. For example, if they have a certain job here at the plant, PG&E has ways to help them get the similar jobs out in the industry after they would leave here. And then, of course, decommissioning. Some may want to say, I'd like to stay here and do the decommissioning for some years, and that's a possibility as well. So after talking with them, we felt pretty good about the Employee Resource Center. It looked like it appeared it could be very effective in helping employees. In fact, there was an employee in there looking at the various options at the time. She seemed pretty well pleased with the options available to her. Then we met with the NRC, Senior Resident Inspector, which we try to do each meeting as well, either the senior or the resident. And this particular meeting, Mr. Newport, Chris Newport, a senior resident, had his boss with him, or two bosses up, I've forgotten, Tony Vigil, Director of the Division of Reactor Projects at NRC Region 4.
So that's just a little confusing because the Senior Resident Inspector is Chris Newport, and it sounds here like it's Tony, so we'll clarify that. I guess he's right. No, you're right. It's got the correct title. Okay, never mind. We're good.
Appreciate the concern and assistance. So basically, with Tony there, he was new to what we did, so we went over our situation, our history and organization, let him talk about the branch organization. Then we all started talking about emergency preparedness and more or less comparing notes about what we look at, what we look at in emergency preparedness, what the NRC looks at, and we were comparing notes there. And again, as usual, we found that the regular meetings with the NRC are quite beneficial, we think, for us as well as for the NRC. We then talked to one of the experts at the station on the California Independent System Operator load reductions. And I want to say we're not going to call this load following because it's not load following. It's load reductions. We looked first at this first item in quotes, which is a memo of understanding or almost a procedure between the station and CalISO, I'm going to call it. That's the independent system operator. And basically, the document establishes communication channels, agreements, and outlines power reductions and how those are accomplished in various sizes of power reductions. Number three, an example would be non-emergency power reductions of, let's say, 35 to 200 megawatts. And Diablo has agreed they can handle that with a two-hour warning from the Cal ISO, or if it's greater than 200 megawatt reduction, they'd need a 12-hour warning just to be able to get the station prepared and get it down to that level. Once the Cal ISO people have requested and the station has agreed to a reduction, whatever it might be, as per the terms of the agreement, the station has the opportunity to choose which unit they want to maneuver. I guess they could maneuver both of them a little bit, or one of them a lot. But you're not talking about reductions probably much more than 50%, and that would be a little bit rare, probably a lot less than 50%. Item four there, Diablo has not yet been asked by CAISO to reduce power. So to date, there have been no requests. We concluded, based on the discussion, that looks like an effective communication channel, an effective agreement to accomplish load reduction if it needs to happen. In other words, they've got it all set and ready to go in case it needs to happen. Now, I said it's not load following, because load following traditionally is a unit going up and down following the load. It might go down at night when the load is less and up during the day, and we're not talking about doing that. Nuclear plants can do that, but they're not real good at it, generally speaking. I think that's all I want to say.
This isn't load following per se. This is some, maybe it's a one-time emergency, it's something they got to do.
Every now and then, perhaps, reduction.
You know, I mean, rarely, but it could happen from time to time.
Yes.
But it's not going to be like, we want you to do this, every noontime for the next 3 weeks. That's different. It's not that.
That's correct.
Yep.
And, we have heard that PG&E has decided to reduce load in certain areas where there might be fires to take the burden off the transmission
power. Yeah, we understand about the peak clipping stuff.
That could be a situation where they'd ask Diablo to reduce load.
Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
I'm going to go ahead. We met with the observed a notification review team meeting. So what are notifications? Notifications are documents, electronic, generally speaking, although you can print them, used by any plant personnel to document problems in the plant. And as we heard yesterday from the performance improvement person on the corrective action program, he didn't use this number, but he used a number of 22,000 a year or something like that. Anyway, they told us there are typically, during a non-outage period, there are 50 to 100 notifications written per day.
No, but that jives. 22,000 would be, all right, about 60, 70 a day.
Very good. So the math works out. Thank you, Bob. Now, the notifications could be written to change a light bulb. They could be written to correct a pump problem. So that it's all over the field. And disposition by significance.
Yeah.
And the more significant ones obviously get more attention, and the less significant the light bulb notification would just go to the fix it now team and they'd replace the bulb probably. It's like my wife handing me a note to say the screen door is not shutting all the way. I'll just go fix it. That's my notification. Anyway, each notification, some are serious or can be, as item three says there, are promptly reviewed the same day, probably within hours, by work control personnel and by the control room shift manager. Those people look at each and every one every day. And they're looking to see, have they got the right significance to it? Do they need to perform an operability review to be sure this, whatever's having the problem, can be, has a question about its operability or not? Those are pretty rare. And then the next day, the NRT there at item four, the notification review team, they review all of the notifications from the previous day. Now, and they had 137 of them this particular day, and you think, gosh, how can they review 137 notifications in like a 1 hour, 1.5 hour period? They've got a neat little device or a neat little program called OneNote. Right. And they, at the end of the day, previously, in the morning of, this meeting started at 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock. They have, it's a collaborative computer program which they can pull up. They look at each one on the screen and they can mark it. They can look at it and tell. They've gotten pretty good at telling significance levels, responsibility levels, that sort of thing. And they mark that up and they can see each other's markups as they go through this. Mm-hmm. And then they meet in the, I think about half a dozen of them from different functions, maintenance, ops, engineering. They meet in a room and they have on a big screen the combined comments on OneNote. Most of them say, okay, as is, and those, they run through those pretty fast. others that somebody has comments on, they discuss, and they agree on the comments, and they move on. But it's a pretty neat process. It's very effective and very efficient.
Yeah.
Now, after that, number five there, there's a management committee called the Corrective Action Review Board, and they review certain selected significant notifications sometime later. They meet once a week, I think, Hector, or something like that. And we've been to Corrective Action Review Boards, or CARB, C-A-R-Bs, and they do a higher level review of certain ones. So a pretty good process. No notification goes without a significant review, for sure. And our conclusion was that the NRT is effective and efficient. All right, and we're getting close to the end of this report. Our next item was we met and observed the Emergency Response Organization, or ERO, muster meeting. So the ERO is the Emergency Preparedness Organization at the station. It's the people who participate in that, and there are four teams. And to maintain each team, I think, has a two-week period where they're on call, so to speak. And they have to maintain their proficiency with regular training, and they do this at the beginning of the two-week period. The meetings they go to, they all collect in a big room, and those are called ERO muster meetings. And the muster meetings provide the ERO personnel with updates to procedures, updates with techniques, operation experience from other stations, from here, things they need to know to perform their jobs best. And in addition to the updates and training, they include a dynamic learning activity, which in this case was a video which was made of an event that happened at Diablo Canyon, I don't know, 12 or 15 years ago, where they had lost residual heat removal cooling. And actually, they did a reenactment of that with the actual people that were in it, the ones that were still there. And they did quite a nice job with it. It was very, very well done. Yeah, very professionally done, almost, you might say. And very effective, and it got a good discussion going. I thought it was a very nice learning.
When I went to one of those in the fall, I can't remember whether it was with you or
no, it was with Rick.
I think it was with Rick, right?
Yeah.
Just before the drill, just after the drill.
That's correct. And it seemed to me that there were, 50, 60 people in the room?
Yeah. I think there's 70 on each team.
And every one of them has a day job to which they go back.
That's right.
But this is, now, there are four teams, so every 8 weeks they're on for two and off for six.
Yes.
Right?
Correct.
So this muster meeting occurs for any individual every 8 weeks. They go, because their 2 weeks is just about to start, right?
My understanding, yeah. Yes. Concluding that the meeting was performed in a very professional manner, very effective, and got good discussion.
I thought so, too.
Now, seismic workplace safety. We pair, and one of us, Rick and myself, we'll review this every couple times a year, I'd say, pair, would you? And what is seismic workplace safety? It's the practice of securing items in the plant, in a lot of cases furniture, so it won't injure personnel during an earthquake or following an earthquake, and it won't block personnel passageways where people need to get their jobs done or to get handle an emergency situation. Both corporate and Diablo Canyon have a standards document for bracing furniture, which looks pretty effective, I think. Mm-hmm. It describes what furniture has to be braced, et cetera, et cetera. And we've been tracking this, I think, since 2012, period. It might have been before that, but a pretty good while. And each time we inspect some areas of the plant. And in this case, we found two examples of some unsecured furniture. One was in the radiation control area when we went in to look at the safety injection pumps. We had to go in and get our TL, thermoluminescent dosimeter badges and other radiation control equipment. And in that room were four or five tall cabinets, four that looked like this. And I can't tell if that's you or me. I think it was me shaking. And it shook. And so our we were with a safety injection system engineer who took this photo.
Supposed to be tied down at the top.
And we indicated to him, well, these cabinets are not secured. He made a note of it, wrote a notification, and we believe it was fixed.
I want to tell everybody that every bookcase and cabinet in our house is tied down at the top.
Well, Perry and I are going to come visit you one day.
Okay, you got to come to, if you don't want to know how I'm coming, I'll show you.
And so usually it's Perry shaking something, or we're looking back to see if it's secured properly to the wall or whatnot. And then, and the Employee Resource Center, which was a new center, that was all new stuff, they had not yet secured a few cabinets. Mm-hmm. They wrote another notification there. So.
When we noted that, the thing that's impressive is that immediately there was a notification put into the corrective action program so that the problem was recorded and would get fixed. That's the nice thing about having a corrective action program is that when things need to be fixed, they get fixed. That doesn't happen in public universities, at least, all the time.
It doesn't. Well, it does happen in my laboratory.
So we've concluded that the program has been implemented with partial effectiveness. For the most part, they've got a good program, but there's just a few things that we find periodically, and we bring to their attention, and they do something about it. And we meet with Tom Baldwin, who I think is program manager, or he's the management person in charge of the program, his people. And he agrees they could do better, and hopefully they will be doing better. But they've got most everything done. I can't really complain about anything. So anyway, that concludes the fact-finding report. I sent it out a few weeks ago, and I think I've got comments back from committee members, and the one I sent out for this meeting incorporates those comments, so it's ready for consideration of approval.
So I want to start by asking if other members of the committee have any further comments or questions before we move on. Anything? We'll entertain comments or questions from members of the public.
Dr. Gene Nelson, Californians for Green Nuclear Power. And on the page for California Independent System Operator Load Reductions, this is one of my favorite areas. And in a recent PUC filing by Californians for Green Nuclear Power, we looked at the net demand trend for Thursday, June 14th, 2018. And we found that the minimum load that day was at approximately 4 in the morning, and it was 24,000 megawatts. So since Diablo Canyon Power Plant produces 2,240 megawatts, that is approximately 10% of the
minimum load.
Of the minimum load for that workday. I do think it's very important because I've seen some very misleading statements that Diablo Canyon should operate under load following. If we actually had a rationally designed loading order in this state, which we do not, we would never see this consideration. But even with this irrational loading order that we have, it is not a problem. We shouldn't. That's all I'm going to say.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other public comment?
Just fire doors. How are the fire doors?
Please, with the microphone.
That was yesterday's fact-finding
meeting. Yesterday we had a fact-finding report. Sherry Lewis asked about fire doors. Yesterday we had a fact-finding report in which the fire doors topic was covered. And we can give you a brief.
It's actually more of a joke than anything, because in the past, fire doors came up so many different public meetings. And I noticed that there's no fire door problem.
Well, we had it yesterday. By the way, it's true that it's way better. They've pretty much licked it.
Oh, yeah. I reported on that yesterday. And we can pull that slide up if you want to see it. But it's in your book, actually, the March fact-finding meeting from yesterday. Anyway, things are good.
Um,
So, with this report behind us, I'm going to entertain a motion that we accept this report.
I move to accept the report as written.
I'll second the motion.
And that favor? Sorry.
It's approved.
Right, and what that means, as I always say, is that it becomes a matter of public record and now also becomes a chapter in our annual report. And with that, the final agenda item on this public meeting has been accomplished. And so unless anybody has an item to raise, and perhaps there is, we'll be ready to adjourn. Rick?
Just a couple of quick follow-up items from my fact-finding. I did look at the ISPA-CU-FSAR. Region 1 for spent fuel canister is the center 12 assemblies. They're classified as Region 1.
So that's 4 times 3 in the middle.
It's not exactly. It's kind of an H pattern or cross pattern.
It's a cruciform.
Correct.
Yeah.
Thank you. The table I demonstrated was correct. It's used for high burn-up fuel. And surprisingly, you're allowed to put the higher burn-up fuel in Region 1 in the core, and the less burn-up fuel, the fuel requirements are lower for the external ones. And I don't know why that is, but it's
two things. You need to balance the thermal loading on the canister as well as shielding the radiation.
I want to ask Hector before we adjourn.
The other thing is that you'll set up large scale circulation of the helium.
Okay. Right. That could
and
be part of it.
It'll go up the center and down the outside because it gets heated in the middle and cooled as it goes down.
Mm-hmm. So,
no.
Ah. Yes, and which would make sense since we're talking about a lot of the thermal modeling improvements and such, and we know there's been, over the last 10 years, tremendous improvements in modeling of convective fluid flow. Anyway, just to give you that feedback, answer those questions.
Mm-hmm. Good. Okay. A couple more items. I want to ask Hector Garcia whether you have any feedback about the dates that we had tentatively thought about yesterday, and if not, we'll learn later.
No, I have not looked into that. I'll be back at the plant tomorrow morning.
That's
and
fine.
And I'll email DCIC.
Yeah, just let us know.
Thank you.
We obviously can't set dates for future activities without making sure the plant can support it. And they almost always can, and sometimes if they can't, we have to account for that. One last thing is I want to be sure that you understand that the effectiveness of this meeting for the public depends in a large part on AGP, and they're right here, and I want to thank them for the good work they do. And if you don't know how good it is, go to one of those website boxes and click on it, and you'll see how good the quality is of the audio and the video, and that's unusual and good for you guys. Thank you very much. Finally, the next public meeting, just like this, will be on October 23 and October 24, which is easy to say is 4 months hence, plus a little. With that, I want to then finally thank Bob Rathy, without whom the logistics on our side would not have been as effective as they are, and also your support, which means Denise and others in their office with whom we interact in a crucial way when it really matters. Thank you very much, Bob.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
And I'm going to call this meeting to a close. The next public meeting, the chairman's going to be Peter Lamb.